Hello everyone and welcome to the History of Scotland, Episode 3, The Roman Interlude, Part 2. Now the small town of Clackmannan, population 3,348, sits just over the north side of the River Forth, over the Kincardine Bridge. It's therefore north of the line of the Antonine Wall. In the town square is the stone from which the town draws its name, the Stone of Mannow. That name itself is confirmation of what the later Roman histories tell us about the tribes of northern Scotland. Cassius Dio, describing the 3rd century campaign of Emperor Severus, talks about just two tribes north of the Antonine Wall, nothing like the 10 that Ptolemy told us about, and these two are the Caledonians and the Maetae. The Maetae would just be on the wall, and the Caledonians beyond them. It might well be that the shades of the Maetae are a little grumpy that for some reason it's Caledonia that has become the alternative word for Scotland rather than Mannow. There is no accounting for blind chance. Last time we talked about the fact that although officially outside the Roman province of Britannia, commerce and discussion between the peoples of northern Britain and the Roman province of Britannia were still common. The period between Agricola's campaign up to the year 84 and the end of the 2nd century was an era characterised by some confusion about exactly where the borders of the province should be. Antonine, Hadrian, oh, so difficult. It was the Emperor Severus who had resolved that confusion once and for all, and usher in a period of pretty peaceful coexistence for some time. In 195, the Roman governor of Britannia was moved, and this change in leadership seems to have set off another round of violence with the northern Britons, and this time it seems to have been the Maetae who were the main instigators and the main culprits. It could have been that the Maetae saw an opportunity, some uncertainty among the Romans that gave them a chance for a smash-and-grab raid. Or it could have been that this change of personnel or policy, or cack-handed new boy who caused some specific grudge. Either way, Herodian, the historian, spoke of the barbarians, quote, laying waste the countryside, carrying off plunder and wrecking almost everything. A man called Virius Lupus was sent to quieten things down, which he did, with the judicious application of cash, which may of course have been the Maetae objective right from the start. And they very probably considered the matter to be closed, counted their silver, brought some high-status Roman goods and went back to the land. Unfortunately, they were dealing with an emperor determined to make a name for himself and who was pretty hard-bitten and experienced. Emperor Severus was in his 60s by the time he arrived in Britain in 208. He was a Libyan, from the magnificent city of Leptis Magna on the African coast, and he'd been emperor for the last 15 years or so. He knew what he was doing. He'd spent a fair proportion of his life on campaign, was no stranger to violence and a bit of light ravaging on a Sunday afternoon. He also suffered from gout or arthritis, and this had heightened the level of grumpiness that could be expected. When he arrived, the Maetae were worried enough to send ambassadors to smooth things over and ensure there were no regrettable outbursts of violence. They were sent away with a collective flea in their ears, which maybe gave them a clue as to what was about to follow. Severus seems to have been very clear about what he was after. Before the war started, he authorised a major upgrade of Hadrian's Wall, so he envisaged no conquests. He wanted to teach the Maetae and the Caledonians a lesson, embed an agreement with them for long-term peace, and then leave. Over the next year, the Maetae and the Caledonians took a very sensible approach to the war. They ran away, into the hills, and avoided any idea of a pitched conflict along the Calgarcus model, because they knew full well that the Calgarcus model did not end well for the relatively poorly equipped local. That does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that the Romans had free rein, very much the opposite. But the Maetae and Caledonians chose the raid and the tactics of guerrilla warfare much, much more suitable. And there are very good points about this tactic, involving the retention of life and limb in the same body, which is a major advantage. But there are disadvantages to boot, namely that their farms lay undefended and they were duly burned. At which point we get to a rather fun meeting. The leader of the Maetae was named as one Argentacoxus. And while the war was in progress, he decided it was time for a bit more jaw-jaw with old Severus. All he was saying was that it was time to give peace a chance. he came with his wife, a Caledonian princess, maybe to reduce the temperature, to emphasise war negotiation as a family occasion. While Argentococcus tried to find a way to restrain the hand of Roman retribution, his princess and Severus's wife, Julia Domina, met. If accurately recorded, bit of an if. It was an edgy sort of affair. Something like the meeting of Gwendolen and Cecily in The Importance of Being Earnest. The Empress mentioned, en passant, that she'd heard that the Maiti believed in free love and would have sex with pretty much anybody. The princess returned implied insult with insult. We fulfil the demands of nature in a much better way than you Roman women do, for we consort openly with the best men, whereas you let yourself be debauched in secret by the vilest. Ha! Nice one. Up yours, Julia. Burn. Maiti 1, Roman Empire 0. I imagine the rest of the session was reasonably frosty as well, but who knows. The blokes, however, were no more successful, and Argentococcus went away without his peace. Now Cassius Dio's characterisation of the campaign leads to a conclusion that the Maiti and the Caledonians led such a successful campaign that Severus lost 50,000 men, and he was forced to withdraw to do some wound licking and plan his next campaign, and that while he was doing that in 211 he died in Eboracum, or York as she'd become known, and his son Caracalla swiftly abandoned the campaign and headed back to Rome to seek his fortune. But Cassius Dio wasn't a Severus supporter, and his account needs to be taken with a pinch of salt. Actually, Caracalla and Severus seem to have put the land of the Maiti and Caledonians comprehensively and conclusively to the sword, maybe all the way north to the Murray Firth. But it's also true to say that clearly the tribes led a violent and successful guerrilla campaign that cost the Romans dear. Though the death of Severus and Caracalla's burning desire to be away to pursue his career ambitions emperor-wise also served their purpose well. But however you characterise it, the settlement that emerged from the campaign was to prove remarkably successful. We don't know what it said, but we can see the results and the outcomes. And the main one of these was over 150 years of relative peace on the northern frontier. One of the things that helped this was clarity. There was to be no more messing about with the frontiers. The formal limit of Roman Britannia was Hadrian's Wall. North of the wall, relationships would be carried out by spies, not sneaky about, for your eyes only, don't open the shark gate, Blofeld kind of spies, but exploratores, men sent from the empire to formally observe the barbarians, to work with them, negotiate with them. For some time after 211, it looks as though Roman outposts were maintained north of the River Tay, and therefore north of the line of the Antonine Wall, and they were probably home to diplomats, traders, slavers, officials. It was a defence-in-depth system, of which the wall was just a part, behind those relationships developed with the inhabitants of Outer Brigantia and Inner Caledonia that worked for both parties. So, what were these societies like in northern Britain during the Roman period? Let us talk, gentle listeners, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, or alternatively, let's talk about the societies of northern Britain and the impact or otherwise that Rome had on them. Were they, in fact, completely unaffected by the Roman invasion, as has been suggested by some historians, who left no legacy? A period we should describe as the Roman interlude, or in fact, did the empire have an impact on the way those societies formed and developed? In the first episode, we talked about the Brocks and the Hillforts, and the suggestion that such structures indicated the emergence of elites within these previously very flat societies. The question is, though, what kind of elites? Were these formally structured societies like those we might recognise from medieval times onwards with, you know, kings, nobles, peasants, and with the emergence of central government, however rudimentary? Or were these elites a bit more like gangsters, where within a mass of people, some stood out through their own efforts or wealth and their ability therefore to influence more people or gather more clients than others? Well, of course, as we said, more than once anything is possible. But it seems most likely that these societies largely were free from complex and formal hierarchies. Again, that's not to suggest there were no hierarchies. There almost certainly were. But one handy description or phrase is civil society. And indeed at this time, the Caledonians and Maiti and the tribes of Outer Brigantia could probably qualify as civil societies, fully civil societies. and at this point it would probably be sensible for me to explain myself and defend the definition of the phrase as handy, which at this point you might feel is open to debate. The idea is that civil societies were self-regulating through informal structures and relationships rather than through third-party institutions, the pretty much complete absence of any of the formal machinery of government. The phrase farmer republics has also been used. The kind of society being described is one of isolated farms connected by cultural ties more than formal relationships such as lordship. Again, that's not to suppose that such a society was without its elites and its hierarchies. The main one would have been defined by a kind of legal status. There would have been freemen, who were fully paid-up members of society and part of the consensus that would form decisions. But then there would have been a category of semi-free. This group may have fallen on hard times at some point, been forced to, I don't know, set up a history members podcast to make ends meet, or more likely, to give up some of their rights to free status, to be explicit, and give an example, maybe they lacked the land to be independent and support their own family, and so in return for support, they might commit some of their time and labour to a neighbour. And then finally, there would have been the unfree, slaves, with no rights at all. And we know that one of the things that the Romans desired from their relationships with Barbaricum in northern Britain was access to slaves for the markets of the empire. And there's little doubt they were able to buy slaves from the tribesmen. Now, this does sound rather lovely, doesn't it? Not the slavery bit, obviously, but the idea of a fully civil society, a world away from the world of warlords and great men, imposing their rule on others, demanding tribute and taxes. The very phrase, self-governing farmer republics, raises a vision of paradise, or an anarcho-syndicalist self-governing republic of which Dennis would have been proud, in which free men and free women gambled together amongst the heather. But be careful, there may also have been drawbacks. And here is another matter for debate. This is the wonder, the joy and delight of studying a period of history this obscure. There is endless opportunity for furious argument and precious little way of resolving them definitively. So, in the blue corner, well, I don't know, let's call them optimists. The self-governing farmer republics, they say, are broadly speaking non-violent societies. The Brochs and Hillforts are part of the display of the emerging elite, no more than that. Look around the landscape, you will see widely scattered, isolated farmhouses with no sign of defensive structures. This is a peaceful society without the need for nucleated villages and defence against marauders. In the red corner, the pessimists paint a radically different picture and draw on what we know from anthropology to boot. A fully civil society has the advantage of nobody to impose taxation, but the disadvantage is the absence of a third-party authority to resolve disputes and enforce the law. The pessimists argue that such societies that depend on a fully consensual legal system are in the end dependent on allowing vengeance as compensation for injury, blood feuds in effect. Pessimists argue that the vast majority of fully civil societies continuously wage total war, attacking their enemies to strip them of their cattle and women, destroy their houses and enslave their men. The evidence presented by isolated, undefended farmhouses is open to alternative interpretation. Not that there was no war, but that it was impossible to defend such places, and so that the response to violence was flight. They didn't fight. They ran away to the hills when the attacks came, and hid until the attackers have gone. Far from being a paradise, they say, fully civil societies lived their lives in a constant state of fear. Well, I don't know the answer, obviously, though I find myself swayed by the argument that there's no compelling reason why the communities of northern Britain should have evolved so radically differently to societies elsewhere. As we've said, we know from grave goods and structures such as the Brochs that there was an elite of some kind. The kind of people that listen routinely to high-quality history podcasts, the type of person that stands out from the crowd. Now, interestingly, the Romans seem to have an impact on the way this worked. Like it or loathe it, it seems that access to high-quality Roman goods was a surefire way of either getting yourself high status or, alternatively, a symptom of your existing high statusness. Which isn't great, in the sense that it had been far more heartwarming if it was the local art which defined status. But I guess with a beast like the Roman Empire on your doorstep, it's not that surprising. So when the finds of Roman materials are analysed, it paints a fascinating picture. By Roman goods, by the way, we're talking of jewellery, bronze, glassware, high-quality pottery, stuff like this. It seems to depend where you are. Closest to the Romans, in Outer Brigantia, the land between the walls, there's a wide variety of finds across different types of settlement. The majority of settlements have very few finds, a few have a very substantial amount, and there's a sort of middle tier in the middle. It speaks of quite a lot of hierarchy and structure. Further away from the empire, in Inner Caledonia, the pattern is less complex. There are just the haves and the have-nots. And if you go further out to Atlantic Scotland, there's no differentiation at all between sites. It raises a fascinating conclusion that the further away from empire, the flatter and less structured were the Scottish communities. So, you know I said it would be weird to say somewhere was remote in the Stone Age a couple of episodes ago. Well, now it appears as though there is, for the first time, somewhere to be far away from, which is a shame. Think about this a little more, and it has even more consequence. It seems relatively straightforward to suppose that Roman goods would be easier to get hold of the closer you are, just a matter of logistics. But the fact is that proximity also appears to be affecting the very structure of native society. An example is the appearance in later antiquity of a new dominant burial rite in Outer Brigantia and the Maiatai homeland, i.e. just north of the River Tay. Bodies were now laid on their backs in stone-lined graves laid east to west with no grave goods. They suggest strongly that Christianity had reached northern Britain through the empire. It also suggests equally strongly that places like Outer Brigantia and the Maiatai were enthusiastic Romanisers. We're a world away from the lovely image of the noble and free Celtic society fighting for freedom from the cultural and political domination of the Romans. We're in a much more believable world where the Outer Brigantian tribes like the Wotadini and as far up as the Maiatai took a look at the Roman culture and rather liked it. However, before you cry foul at this desecration of the traditional image, the situation in Inner Caledonia might be rather different. There, a new burial tradition similarly emerges, but it is significantly different. Here, although similar graves appear, they're covered by a burial mound and surrounded by a ditch. Now, this is difficult to interpret. It could be the adoption of Roman culture with a local twist. Equally, it could be a conscious rejection of Roman culture. Or it could simply be that the further away from the empire you went, the weaker its influence. There's an illuminating parallel along the Rhine. There, the Franks were heavily influenced by Roman culture, whereas the more distant Alemanni were affected only lightly. Now then, in the light of all this, let's return to the tradition, in the words of one historian, that the Roman Empire was a pimple, a wart on the buttock that was Scottish history. Actually, they didn't say that, but you know, the general sentiment, in the words of one historian, that Scotland emerged from the Roman period, quote, untouched by even the thinnest veneer of Romanisation. So this is where the phrase the Roman interlude comes from, the idea that the Romans passed across the Scottish sun in the briefest of moments, failing hardly to register. What do we think of that, gentle listeners? Does that sound right? I would suggest that it's a question of degree, because in one sense, actually, it's a fair conclusion. The societies of northern Britain were not conquered by the Romans. They did not become self-consciously Roman. They didn't adopt Roman culture wholesale. They didn't build amphitheatres and shout, Hail Caesar! And if that is the test, then fair enough. But it is setting the bar very high. If instead you set the test as whether or not the Roman Empire had a significant impact on the societies of northern Britain and changed them radically, then there's much more of an argument to have. Both the Romans and the indigenous peoples had an interest in each other. The Romans sought contact and influence to both defend their provinces, but also to gain access to trade, slaves, furs, for example. They had powerful weapons in this, in the very human emotions of snobbery, ambition, desire for an easy life. Because people in societies like the Wotadini and the Maiatai wanted access to Roman material and culture. In fact, it was often the people of northern Britain who themselves became the greatest force towards Romanisation of their societies through their own advocacy. The sort of, oh look how advanced we are lying down to eat supper, why don't you do it too, kind of thing. There are more altruistic reasons as well. If I can take you back to the civil society and blood feud thing, history is littered with societies going to Rome to ask for help in resolving or mediating their own internal disputes. It would be rather remarkable if the same thing hadn't happened in northern Britain. So for many communities in Outer Brigantia and Inner Caledonia, the Roman period introduced enormous change. It's striking that until the crises of the 4th century, after Severus, the relationship between northern British communities and Rome was marked by peace, not war. The period saw the development of a much more structured and complex societies, introduced new cultural ideas, affected regional identities and religious observances. And in this, northern Britain was following a well-trodden path around the empire. It's reasonably clear that there's not a matter of Roman policy about how all this was managed. The Romans were making it up as they went along, just like everyone else. They were no more in control than anyone else. But the process around the frontier land, all over the empire, was similar. And so as you go further out to Atlantic Scotland, Outer Caledonia if you like, the impact of the Roman Empire became less significant, or at least less obvious. But for many, the Roman interlude was a period where the fight was for more access to Rome than a fight for freedom from it. Now then, I only recently realised that one of the joys of doing Shedcasts is that there's really no reason why I need to be aiming for episodes of roughly equal lengths, 4,000 to 5,500 words. The discussion about the Roman interlude seemed like a jolly good place to stop. So do you know what? I'm going to stop. Ha! Triumph. It means that next time we can introduce one of the sexier topics of Scottish history. I speak of the mysterious Picts. That will be a couple of weeks away on the 9th of April. And so in the meantime, gentle Shedcasters, thank you so much for your support. Good luck and have a great fortnight.